So we have a good 40 minutes for discussion. There's one thing I forgot to say in my intro, which is there was supposed to be another panelist here, Mustafa Henaway, who's with the ISM in Janine, but he decided not to come because of fears at the border. Mustafa's from Toronto, but he's also Arab. And, I think it's important just to mention that he was supposed to be here, but the border meant that he decided not to come. Let's start the discussion, and we want to kind of avoid Q&A, although there are things that we might need to respond to. So we're going to take 3 or 4 comments / questions, and so we really count on you for this. So I just want to see a few hands, and I'll know where to go. Okay, we'll start with Marina, and we'll go around.
Okay, I'm Marina. I'm actually not going to talk about Palestine. And this provoked, it was a fabulous panel, because it provoked so many thoughts and kind of like my heart was beating fast at certain moments, which is always a really good thing. But I'm actually not going to do that. I'm going to talk about 2 things briefly, I hope, so we could all talk. But the first one is actually something that Jaggi spoke about in the beginning, or just kind of referenced, just kind of like who do we decide we're doing solidarity with globally. And an experience I had recently, my mother lives in Cuba, and so I was in Cuba in May just visiting and have lots of friends and whatever. And this was the same time it just happened that laws get enforced, that Cubans can't get money from the US and people can't visit, and all of these more horrible laws are getting enacted. And so I went to the march with like 1 million other people in Havana, and I'm not even gonna go into my criticism of the Cuban government, it's not even worth it anymore. They're so there. But on this march, folks are just asking me, I'm talking to them, oh, we're so glad, you're from the U.S. and you're with us, so what are people doing? It's kind of like, well, there are some people doing things. And then my friends later are like, okay, so what's your movement? Knowing I'm part of the anti-authoritarian, kind of part of this global justice movement. So what are you all doing? And it was this like horrible moment of like, thinking to friends of mine who think the Cuban government is worse than capitalism, or, have said all kinds of things. Anyway, so just to kind of put that out there as just one example of like how do we make these kinds of decisions and what happens in our kind of culture, community, politics that we wouldn't work against, say, a blockade in one country, but would work in solidarity with another. And obviously the world is huge, but I think there's something particular around Venezuela and Cuba and around the politics of Marxist-Leninism. And I share the critique, but does that mean we don't act in solidarity with people who are either being invaded or have blockades and things like that? I think it's a big question. Second part, now we're going to another part of the world, which I spent a lot of the last year in Argentina working on this oral history, and in the time being there, saw a lot of folks kind of come and go and visiting. And I'm actually not against, we see inspiring things around the world. We kind of loosely speaking about this movement. And so you want to go, and you want to go to Chiapas, or you want to go to Argentina and see like, wow, what cool stuff's happening. And I actually think that's okay to want to do that, but it's thinking about how we do that and what we bring back and what we're doing and how we engage with folks in the movements there. And it is a question, and I like to always kind of put out there is like, what are the movements? You want to talk to the movements. You can't go talk to movements. Who are those movements? There are many movements if we believe that. You can't actually go and have a conversation. It's not like, I guess I was involved also with Nicaragua Solidarity. It was very easy. The Sandinistas, okay, the ANC, this is easy, but this is not, the world's very different and in a beautiful, wonderful way, but also more complicated. But figuring out how we do that, how we have conversations, so we're not just going and, okay, we're going to collect inspiring experiences or write about it and share it with people in the global north, but also how we're interacting with folks. And so this is an example of Argentina, then what are we also doing with folks in the movements to contribute in whatever way? And I don't just mean kind of farming while we're with people there, but if you're writing about it, if you're filming, have you engaged with people on the ground to say, well, what would be useful? What would be useful maybe in documenting something that you have? I have these resources or privileges, whatever. And thinking about maybe how to share that back again. Because I know so many people have actually written articles and books and made films, and so many of them are in English or in German or in French, and actually don't go into Spanish and never get back to the same communities. And I think this is a huge problem in our relationships with movements. If we don't have the resources to do both, then I think we should question doing what we're doing, I guess. At all, and it's hard, I've been working on this oral history, so the draft of the book has been in the movements in Argentina now for quite a while, and I kind of like to know what people think, and I haven't heard, and so it's tense, and it's hard, and it's messy, but I think we have to just kind of get into the mess, figure it out. The last one is just really teeny, but it's on the idea of tours, and bringing people from other parts of the world, and thinking about when we do that, because I think it's important to exchange experiences here, but thinking about, again, engaging with the movements and getting into the kind of mess of who are the movements and how are we having these conversations, but seeing what their priorities are. Because I think too often it's like showing people around the US or Europe or Canada rather than actually engaging and seeing what would be useful for their movements and explaining to them maybe some of the possibilities. They might want to talk to labor unions, even if that's not who we'd like them to talk to. And kind of figuring that out.
If people want to, I'm going to keep us because this because I'm going to do an alternating list. So I have Aaron and you and Matthew and Neil. Is there anyone else who would like to speak at some point during the discussion? Okay, John. Okay, go ahead. I don't know your name, sorry.
Will, hi. It was a really good panel. A lot of these issues are on my mind a lot. I've actually been Gaza with the ISM and everything. And I actually, like, I was getting some, like, mixed message within the panel, which is good overall, but, like, on the one side, there's kind of, like, virtually no limitations to the possibilities of solidarity, and also, well, you have to be careful, you know, where you land your solidarity and everything. And so, like, I mean, again, I'm struggling with, like, trying to answer these questions, and, you know, it's a very personal thing, but, like, for example, when I was in Gaza, and, well, out of, you know, cultural sensitivity and training we received from ISM, we were recommended to, you know, not present yourself as atheist if you're an atheist, because that's a very, like, you know, strong thing that might be offensive, you know. And so, you know, I was like, okay, that's, I'll, you know, like, emphasize your upbringing, like, if you were, like, not atheist. But anyway, like, almost inevitably, right off the bat, one of the first people I met hung out with was like, so what are you? Are you Christian or what? And I was like, oh, wow. So, I mean, my point is, like, that there's also a certain, you know, your own personal honesty puts limits on solidarity in some situations, especially, I mean, there are lots of examples, like, even domestically, when any groups are, like, engaging in some kind of solidarity with each other, you know, there's a long history of some groups being opportunistic and withholding, you know, withholding their own values and not being transparent, and, you know, sometimes with sinister motives, but sometimes just out of, you know, this kind of like utilitarian, like, instrumental, like, you know, I need to hold back this and this in order to, you know, strive for this higher, you know, greater good or whatever. So, I don't know, I'd like to think that there are no limitations to, like, the bounds of solidarity, but there's also, like, certain limitations, your own honesty and things like that. And so, I guess my point is it's really tough to decide where to draw the line.
Okay, yeah.
Jack? What was something that happened?
What's that?
Okay,
You were on,
I had. Yeah, but I basically would like to just invite you all to speak maybe a bit more about this question of solidarity, first opened up by Jackie, and the slogan solidarity is struggle. One thing I've heard is the importance and the potential of local organizing, taking a look at a specific context. Particularly, the suggestion was made that more effective work can be done here on the continent than, say, moving to the Middle East. That might be true. Perhaps I still think there's a lot to be said for the work ISM does, for example. This also is with respect to Palestine. The comment was made that there's a lack of leadership in Palestine, and that's, you know, this is extremely problematic. Again, this could be good, bad, or ugly, but I'm not really seeing how that is exactly a problem. Isn't there a bit of danger or worry of, you know, trying to speak for the Palestinians by, you know, focusing more or less on the kind of work which can happen in specific contexts here, as opposed to letting, you know, the voices which do exist in Palestine speak in their multiplicity, in their diversity. And so, quite exactly, you're not going to find a single leader to represent all those people. And you are going to actually, like, encounter a lot of challenges and a lot of struggle. And isn't that exactly where the moment of solidarity will occur?
Okay. We will take two more speakers and then throw it to the panel. Go ahead.
I'm thinking about it back and just always with solidarity there, because I feel, I work in, like, an anti-war group, and a lot of people in the group are always talking about supporting Iraq and resistance, and that that creates an inevitable conflict. Conflict for me as a mother and a human being, because the Iraqi resistance is killing U.S. soldiers, and I feel like I also have to have solidarity with them, even though they're doing things that I don't approve of. And that, but I think for a lot of young people, just even thinking about self-determination, it's not necessarily like this big free will choice of joining the military. So, like, right, and I feel like people avoid talking about that a lot, like that conflict of. And I don't think you necessarily have to take, I mean, I think you can do solidarity work on both sides in a way, but I think that's a really difficult thing to do, and I just like I think it would be good to talk about that more sometimes.
Okay, just take one more speaker. I know there's people waiting, so Matthew.
I think a lot of what we've talked about is the posture. What is our posture when we doing work in solidarity? This is a really important question. I'd like to ask a couple ideas. When we brought this question up in an international in Ecuador and in Argentina, our response questioning what is international solidarity. It was answered to us that we can definitely tell the difference between people who come and come as tourists, and those who do ongoing work and support them locally. They put their body into it when they're in the location of struggle. And I just heard a journalist friend of mine say that, I think, and a little bit too generous in a way, but she said that the only tourists that she's seen in Argentina lately are the journalists that come down and take photos and come back. But beyond the posture, I wonder what are concrete ways that we can work on the transfer, like for example, the transferring of funds. How do we do that without replicating the position of dependency? And after long conversations with some guerrilleros in Brazil, an idea that came out, and maybe a principle that could be applied to other instances, is that if they have a project that's going to lead to their self-sustainability, their financial self-sustainability, and that's one of the most important ones to support, for example, cooperatives and our collective in Worcester, Mass. Has an ongoing relationship with a Coletivo Ruptura in Brazil that is working on this independent recording studio, for example, that will hopefully self-sustain their autonomous space and movement. And how can we do that while also supporting communication infrastructure to facilitate more connections around the world? And in talking about mutual international solidarity, how can it be mutual? What are we receiving in return? What are we expecting in return? Sometimes I feel like we expect some sort of legitimacy if we're working with movements in struggle. So we're often sending monetary donations, or we're doing these actions. Sometimes they're considered as for a movement. Are we receiving legitimacy, or are we receiving inspiration? And how do we take those bits of inspiration or ideas and let them grow again for now? Look at those here. And one other question is, how do we facilitate connections between similar movements and struggles that are going on here in the U.S. With those going on in other parts of the world, so indigenous struggles and indigenous struggles here, and how is that done logistically, financially?
Sort of layers of discussion here. I think Mark wanted to address sort of a specific question, and then we can go back to the discussion list.
Just real quick, I mean, just to clarify, I mean, I'm all for, of course you want to let a multiplicity of voices be heard and not reduce them to anything. I mean, I actually always am urging people who set up panels on Palestine to include voices of people that are never included, like voices of Islamist people that I may disagree with about everything, but I'm perfectly happy, you know, I want those voices heard and all of that. The question is, in doing solidarity work, if part of what you want to do is to know what the people want you to do, who do you listen to? And the point is, in the case of Palestine, you're going to get 17 inconsistent messages, and it's very hard to draw a conclusion from, you know, do this, don't do that. I mean, the Fatah, for example, doesn't want to have much of anything to do with activists because they think we're kind of the riffraff and they want to associate with authorities. I mean, that's just the reality of the Fatah leadership. You know, there's other, so it's very hard to get any kind of direction. And the only remotely consistent thing that I see coming out of all the many voices, and believe me, I talk to people, you know, all kinds of everything from communist to Islamist, is get the U.S. to stop supporting our oppression. That's the only consistent, even remotely consistent thing. So that's the only message I think you can, with any honesty, say is coming from, you know, the Palestinian people. Could I really quickly just say about this issue about your honesty? I think it's very different to be asked by an individual person versus being asked in front of a group. I mean, so lots of times I've been asked these kind of awkward questions in front of big groups of, say, Muslims or something, and I just finesse the question. I don't really answer there. If someone asks me, what's your religion, or how do you feel? I try to finesse. If an individual asks me a question, generally I tell them the truth. I mean, I talk to them, and because then you're in a context in which you can say it, you know, try to set it up respectfully and say this and do everything, you know. I think that the training that ISN is worrying about is you know, more or less the idea of people going in and saying, you know, what's all this religious shit? Can't you get God out of this? Don't you people know there isn't a God? Like, you know, that sort of attitude, I think, which really does happen. Yeah.
Okay. I had just a quick comment too that's coming up. I didn't bring it up in my main remarks because of lack of time, and also it opens up a whole ball of wax, but just in doing solidarity, understanding the role of diasporic communities. And so when people are talking about cultural appreciation, that's why I mentioned Mustafa, because when Mustafa goes to Palestine, he doesn't have the privileges of a white person. And people from those communities, I come from one of those communities, sort of deal with this day to day. I just remember being in India and visiting my relatives, and they, on my mother's side, who are Christian, and they realized that I've given up on Christianity, and it was a scandal. And so finessing, as you called it, something. But it also applies to the nature of the struggle and who we're making links with. Obviously, the diasporic community, just for lack of a better term, I'm calling it that, but people who are Arab and from Africa and from Latin America, who live amongst ourselves and are part of our struggles here, you know, it's layered, it's complex, but it's important that that we incorporate that. And so I'm opening that up a bit, just people take that into account as we do the discussion, but also in terms of Palestine, just throwing out, because I agree with a lot of what Mark said, but what do we get behind? There is a movement called Al-Awda, which is made up of a lot of Marxists, but still is based on a principle of the right of return, which is a defining thing that kind of, and Hamas on the right of return is actually good, and Fatah fudges it and is bad, and you end up weird things. But I mention Al-Awda because it relates to the diaspora as well, because Al-Awda, they're refugees by definition, but a lot of the refugees who live in Western Europe and in North America who are giving a lot of momentum to that. It's you know, it's relatively young. The right of return isn't young, but the organizing around Al-Awda is kind of young, and we'll see where it goes. But I just wanted to throw that out as well. To go back to the list, we have Aaron and John, I know. I just want to know, because I'm sort of trying to get, not have all guys always speak. So are there other people who want to speak? Just put up your hand, I'll put you all down. Tomorrow. Okay, so go ahead, and then Aaron, John, and go ahead.
My name is Hillary, and I live actually with Sarah in the West Bank with the ISM. And thank you all for speaking, because these are all issues that I'm thinking about a lot in solidarity work, and I think it's I think these are all the issues that really define being an anarchist in this movement, and I really like what you said, I haven't heard that before, ask Andy Walk. And I think it's always so important to be considering, okay, like, we're raising money, like, where is it going, and how do we choose that without, you know, overextending our privilege in that. Having the privilege to go back and forth, and all of these things are really important. So it's really great to talk about it. And this sort of thing that's going on in terms of leadership, I think, is another way that we can kind of define our struggle as anarchists, is that it's not necessarily identifying with leadership. It's like, not to simplify it too much, but we're in solidarity with people, and we're in terms of, you know, solidarity with Iraqi people or Palestinian people, especially now, is humanizing those people for a public that doesn't necessarily get that in the media. You know, it's about education and awareness raising here, like you're pointing out, like, this is the terrain that we're dealing with. And in that case, I think leadership is sort of secondary to the connections that we're making, really, personally, which I think everyone who's done solidarity work would agree is sort of the most compelling sort of thing, you know, for me anyway, it really keeps me going, like, those friendships with, like, a 16-year-old or, you know, person who's sort of posted us and we're there, yeah. Like that, and that's, I think, something that's really powerful that we bring home to our own communities. And again, that sort of answers that question of, like, how, you know, how are we relating to that leadership? At the same time, keeping in mind, you know, we're always asking questions, we're critical of how our involvement, you know, how we're applying that involvement.
Okay, we have Aaron, I've been waiting on this.
My name is Aaron. I think it's interesting that a lot of people brought up points about cultural sensitivity. And I especially thought that the point you brought up about homophobia was pretty interesting. And I mean, I agree with you, even though it's, like, it's very hard to agree with that. But I'm just kind of wondering, like, it's just kind of a general question that, because I think it might also be important to, like, set parameters in this in terms of, you know, how much or, like, how far you're willing to go as a solidarity activist in terms of what you can accept. And, like, one thing that popped into my mind when you brought that up, and it's not a very good analogy, but kind of an interesting link, is the case with Jamaica. There's been a lot of debate recently, well, in Montreal media, about, like, dance hall reggae in Jamaica and the fact that it's, like, an extremely homophobic society. I mean, not that our society isn't homophobic, we should be let off the hook, but Jamaica has its particular problems, but there's a lot of solidarity work that needs to be done with Jamaica. I mean, in terms of, you look at the IMF's impact on Jamaica is just, like, one case. And it would be, you could argue, be pretty hard for anyone who is visibly queer or just queer at all to even go to Jamaica, right, in certain parts. And I'm just wondering, like how you would begin to kind of set those parameters in terms of cultural sensitivity.
Okay, Sarah wants to address that, but we'll take the two other people, and then Sarah will make a point. So there's John, and I don't know your name, but go ahead.
I have a few points. A couple of them were just addressed to Mark, perhaps. And one of them was that he said there's no overarching leadership in Palestine, and that's you kind of seemed like there was nobody specifically we're working with. There's no Palestinian people or something. Now, I would disagree because I think what ISM is trying to do is not, it has always been to avoid working with Palestinian leadership, even within something we love with communities, that we're working at, that it works specifically more with families as well as communities and local structures. And so in that sense, it is, it's still kind of maintaining a radical project to some degree that of who we're working with. There are a lot of ways that solidarity work has a positive effect that's beyond just, you know, the obvious. Maybe, you know, Palestinians and internationals, I know, I think they would all agree that, you know, by sending a few thousand internationals there every year, we're not stopping the conflict. It's not going to happen that the work is done here and every Palestinian is ever told you need to go back home and tell the story of what you see. But I think that's essentially really, really important because Palestinians, as well as a lot of Palestinians throughout the world, is that one of the most devastating things to them is feeling isolated. They feel completely isolated. There's no other outsiders there besides internationals. There's no tourists. There's no people visiting, you know. So the only people they see are internationals. And I think it's really good, you know. And so when a Palestinian would say to me, like, oh, where are you from? I would say, oh, I'm from the evil empire, you know. And they're like, well, what do you mean? You know, Britain? I'm like, no. and then they would say, no, you know, every American I ever met was a great person. it's the government that's bad. It's the government policy.
You can do that when you don't get out.
I think it's just a really, really important thing. And then there's other effects of doing solidarity, having internationals on the ground there. For instance, there's a lot of Israeli activists that join internationals now, which may or may not happen, or may not happen as much. And so Palestinians get to work with Israeli activists doing the same kind of work. And that's proven very valuable to both of them. And then, obviously, like kind of the media work that internationals do on the ground. I've been in a lot of the villages where, unless we actually like contacted NPR or Christian Science Monitor, these stories would never, ever be told. Like, for instance, in a small village called Jayus, where they have extremely, a very vibrant women's movement that twice a week was having big protests. And this is, like, something that would be completely invisible otherwise. Let's see. And I think, and also on the solidarity work also is important because Palestinians really, the amazing thing is that how many times I would just be walking down the street and somebody would stop me in the street and say, I want to tell you about what happened today or what happened last week.
Yeah.
And what they want to do is tell their story to you in their own work, in their own way, and it's a way for them to see. You know, not through the PA or something, but through their own experiences to you because they know that you're going to take those words back home with you. And I think that those personal kind of connections are extremely important, even though we are not there stopping the occupation. And, you know, it is all those little things are really, really important. And lastly, I just want to say that anarchists on the ground working with ISM, which I don't know what the percentage is, but it could be 20% of ISMers are anarchists. I think they add some theoretical tools to working in that situation, some activists are coming with a very black and white understanding of a conflict. You know, it's like Israel bad, Palestinians good. You know, that kind of black and white understanding, which is really not helpful to anybody, is obviously any kind of simplification of social reality is dangerous in itself. So, that's what it is.
Okay.
I was just going to add something to the kind of list of no-nos that you're kind of creating. But one thing I've noticed that I thought was really unhelpful was not just when we're acting in solidarity with other groups, is how we act in solidarity with each other when we're acting in solidarity with other groups.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And what I've noticed, particularly with causes that are really sexy, like, you know, I don't know, you know, I was always, it was always couched as like the gringo problem in Chiapas was like, all the solidarity groups would be vying for the attention of the EZLN in such a way that it really undermined our ability as a population, a community, as a solidarity network in the States to be effective in providing stuff. And I saw major projects, which the Zapatistas were really important to them, and they really needed to get done, just completely get dismantled by our own kind of ego issues and competitive issues, which weren't even as dignified as like sectarian infighting. It was really just more personal stuff that was couched in political differences. But it's a real issue. There were no perfect solutions from that, other than us really having to take account of our own responsibility for contributing to that dynamic. But that's something that needs to be deconstructed, because it was really weird and really destructive and ruined, I think, some really great stuff.
Yeah, just off, you just made me think of like sitting in Boudreaux in the International House, and some of the internationals were so absurd. I mean, they were, all the movements we work in, we have struggles with interpersonal struggles, and some of the stuff that went on in ISM with the internationals was just, it was really sad. And it's, the community realizes that too. They realize that there's factions of people not getting along, and that's another thing to think about, of how that's affecting the community. But that's not really what I want to talk about. I wanted to address, and I didn't bring this up, but before, when I go do solidarity work, it's always in farming communities. And because I'm a farmer and Hillary's a farmer and we've done this together, like going to El Salvador and it was a lot more clear cut there. You go to FMLN communities. The whole community is FMLN support, and you go talk about genetic engineering, free trade, and stay with them. Palestinian villages aren't that clear cut. There's Fatah, there's Hamas, there's whoever the forces are, PFLP, PPP. But the fact is that the villages we are going to, most of those people were farmers, and it's all the same. They're having their land taken away no matter what their political thoughts are. They're having their olive trees torn down every single day. And it's going there as a farmer and coming from a place of privilege. Our farm is not going to be bulldozed tomorrow. We're not going to wake up and see razor wire laid down in the middle of our farm. And this is what Palestinians face. And I think I actually tried not to get into political debates when I was in Palestine, hardly at all, except with Palestinians I really trusted, because certain groups can use you to go do this with us, and it will, boost their prestige because internationals are following this group. So really trying to make it somewhat apolitical, believe it or not. I mean, obviously being there is very political, but not engaging in those debates often, unless it's with people that you, like, I try not to. But you can go to these, I think to the West Bank and Gaza we couldn't go to because it's completely shut down. They're already surrounded by a wall, obviously, and almost no internationals can get in there right now. But almost all Palestinians agree they don't want a wall. They don't want an occupation. They want the right to go to Jerusalem. They don't want the settlements. And there are things, many ways you can go there and be part of those movements, because I didn't meet any Palestinian that didn't agree with those. The right of return is that's a sticky situation, Palestinian right of return. But those other issues, basically Palestinians want those. And those rights, and those are their rights. And so, it's hard to do solidarity work with not, obviously influencing some political party or, you don't even know who you're talking to. You don't, when you meet a person, you have no idea if they're Hamas, Fatah, and that's not what I'm going to ask the person. They're a farmer. And they have kids. Oh, and that was the last thing I wanted to say, is solidarity work is playing with kids. It's going out and playing soccer. It's going out and walking in the olive groves with kids. That, I think, is one of the, it was one of my biggest joys. And I think it's really great for kids to see, they see on the news all the time, the U.S. government obviously is funding this, and I think I think it brings some happiness to everyone, which is a huge, huge part of solidarity work. It's not just always being in tear gas or whatever. It's also trying to have fun and have parties with the people that you're going to support.
Can I say one thing about that? I mean,
I agree with most of what John said. I certainly agree with all this. I mean, it is important that Palestinians see Americans who care, and even if it means giving them this false impression of Americans. It's certainly the press work is very important, even in a broader way, I think, actually, that I left that out. But still in all, I mean, I want to come back. What I was talking about was a political strategy for ending the occupation, which is my goal here. I went to, you know, some of the absolutely most moving moments for me a summer ago when I was over was going to a birthday party with a family, you know, and seeing real life happening. But the reality is the birthday parties are ending. Ethnic cleansing is happening. Palestinian culture is being destroyed, and it's being reduced to a little ghetto and everyone else we do now. And none of those personal contacts, you know, I don't mean to sound harsh on that, but none of those personal contacts 10 years from now are going to mean shit if we can't put together a coherent political strategy to put some real pressure on the situation. Because those guys are going to be living in a camp somewhere, and they might have a fond memory of having met some American one day, but their life is going to be ruined. And from that, that's what I don't, there's no, nothing aside from the change things is coming out of, there's no political strategy coming out of Palestine. So we have to think about how to formulate a political strategy against our empire right here, if this isn't going to go really, really ugly. And I think it is going really ugly, really quickly.
Okay, we have maybe 5 minutes, so that's enough time for a couple more comments. Are there anyone else who hasn't spoken yet? Okay, so take you, and then you, and yeah.
My name is Damien, and I came a few minutes late, so I might have missed this. I guess an introduction, but I'm kind of wondering specifically what is it that we mean by solidarity, I guess. I mean, I've heard a few different points made, whether it's specifically, you know, like playing with children or sort of finding or locating ourselves within an international resistance movement here at home, you know, working and fighting against U.S. foreign policy. But what does, on a broader scope, what does solidarity mean? And I feel that, at least indirectly, that we've sort of addressed that here this afternoon, but I feel like there is sort of this conflict, sort of this ideological conflict between how is it that we step outside of our physical location, whether that be in the United States or wherever else in North America, and enter into these other places, these other locations of resistance versus being actually located here in the United States and then, you know, working within the our community or working within our frame of reference. And how is it that we can negotiate that? And I guess more than just posing a question, I guess I'm posing a comment. I know for me, a lot of work that I've been doing over the past few years, I've been doing a lot of male feminist work, and I think that one of the most insightful experiences that I've had, also the most challenging experiences, is realizing that that as sexy and as cool it may be to step into a space of an other, my work is amongst other men. Not to say that I need to be alienating myself, but it's just not going to be changing if I'm not changing, you know, biological men around me and breaking down these walls. And granted, this is kind of a gross example. Maybe it's hard to make that parallel, but I feel like there is a commonality. So, yeah.
Just really quickly, I'm not sure if you missed. There was this like attempt by myself at the beginning to define solidarity. I won't bother to do it again, but I actually have it typed out. So there was that, and there was the proviso. I think it's important to restate it that we're focusing on international solidarity, but we're acknowledging that sites of struggle are, you know, also local. We just, for a matter of focus, are talking about it broad, but and that was just a matter of priority, not priority, but choosing the focus. But I'll finish the list. Mary, do you want to be honest too?
Yeah.
Okay, so Mary, and then you've got the last group there.
Just quickly, I just want to say that I noticed that almost entirely omitted Iraq solidarity, which is very interesting because it's the focus of imperial attention. And yet, very few of us are talking about it, working on it, developing serious strategies around it. So I'll just say that I want to plug the next stop, which is towards an anti-authoritarian commitment to international solidarity, where Andrea will be talking about that. And hopefully, lots of us go because I think it's very important to start talking about this seriously.
And sure. Wayne Stollard. I guess I'm going to feel weird having the last word on this, but I want to jump on something we mentioned in the initial panel about Marxist-Leninist countries, Cuba in particular. And I actually wanted to, the experience I had about 10 years ago working with Cuban Solidarity, which I'm not sure how well I'll generalize it, but I thought it was an interesting thing, which is that I was working in the community development sector in Toronto, where I'm from, and we were working in community development in partnership with organizations in Cuba, and what was interesting, we were explicitly working with organizations that were socialist, not aligned with the state. And I think it's kind of an interesting opportunity that Cuba has, because there's a civil society which is emerging there, which is challenging both the authoritarian central power, but is committed to the goal of the revolution, and democratizing the revolution. And it was a really exciting opportunity where we were working in partnership as NGO to NGO, both committed to neighborhood development, both committed to local democracy, and actually working sort of, and this, I found it's an interesting side of struggle, which is sort of consistent with anarchist ideals, and sort of also consistent with the idea of international solidarity. And so I just wanted to throw that as an interesting possibility, and I wonder if that exists elsewhere.
Okay. Technically we're out of time, but yeah, I guess we should keep to the schedule, be on time for once. So thanks everyone for coming.